Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, will commemorate its 70th anniversary next month at a time when the strength and vibrancy of the alliance is being questioned. It also comes at a time when relations with Russia, the raison d'etre of the alliance, is at its lowest point since the Cold War. A recent report by two former U.S. ambassadors to NATO, Nicholas Burns and Douglas Lute, have called NATO, quote, an alliance in crisis, unquote. The report cites a lack of American leadership, starting with President Trump's questioning of the value of the alliance, European members' lack of commitment to collective defense spending, NATO's own commitment to democracy and freedom by its reaction to speech and press restrictions within several member states, and criticism of the organization's decision-making. Yet despite that, most observers and public opinion is firmly in support of NATO and the protections it offers to the over 900 million citizens of Europe and North America. My guest today is Stephen Hill, the director of the Office of Legal Affairs for NATO. In this role, he's the chief legal advisor to Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Prior to joining NATO, he served as counselor for legal affairs at the U.S. mission at the United Nations. Earlier in his career, he led the legal unit at the International Civilian Office and the European Union's Special Representative in Kosovo. He served as a legal advisor at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad for two tours from 2004 to 2005 and again in 2007. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. He joined us this morning here on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Hill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich.
NATO will celebrate its 70th anniversary next month at a time when there seems to be broad concern about the future of the alliance. What is the sense of the membership as they head into this 70th anniversary?
Well, I think that this year is a really important year for NATO. As you say, the North Atlantic Treaty was signed in Washington on April 4th, 1949. Secretary of State Pompeo is going to host a commemorative event with all the foreign ministers, as well as with my boss, NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. We're looking forward to it. I think the sense is positive. If you look back at NATO's history, it's really clearly the most successful military alliance in history. It's been successful because we've been able to adapt to different security challenges. NATO was born in the Cold War, worked at the defense of Western Europe from a Soviet attack for many years, and then was able to successfully, you know, adapt its mission to the different security challenges. So whether it was the Balkans, Bosnia, Kosovo in the 90s, or responding to 9/11, Afghanistan in the 2000s, or now as we see the new security environment in Europe with threats both coming from the east of the alliance, but also from the south, you know. It's really been successful in that regard. So I would say that our 29 allies are positive and, you know, focused how we can keep this alliance as a vibrant force for security in the future.
Now, that wouldn't be a universally shared opinion right now because there's a lot of people who are saying that the alliance is in crisis. As you well know, just last month at the Munich Security Conference, which, of course, is a much larger gathering than just NATO states, there was a very apparent divide between the United States and most of the participants in the security conference. Is that an issue for NATO?
Well, I think you have to look at the big picture, too. I mean, that was a very important annual conference, but there were also a lot of messages that came out about the need to work together to deal with the problems that face both sides of the Atlantic. We have strong institutions. We have a strong alliance. We're making progress in a lot of areas. So I actually see NATO's not only the past as very strong, but also the future is very strong.
There was good news. Recent polling, I think from Gallup, suggests that large majorities in the United States and in Germany, where there's also issues with NATO, still support the alliance.
Yeah, I think that's an important poll. I think that does show that there's wide popular support, not only in those two countries, but across our 29 allies. You know, we also have a new ally that'll hopefully be coming online soon, the Republic of North Macedonia, which is the end of a lengthy process of resolving the dispute about the name of that country. And so that's a really good news story too. You know, so you have NATO, you know, not only continuing to provide value for the populations, but also having an open door, and I think being seen as something that is valuable. So I think that poll is a very important thing.
Let's talk about one of the big areas of criticism of where the alliance is now, and that came from two former U.S. ambassadors to NATO who are now at the Harvard School of Government, Nicholas Burns and Douglas Lute. The ambassadors issued a report last month at that Munich Security Conference, which suggests that the alliance is in crisis, and called for four major areas of emphasis to improve the alliance. And the first of all was the revival of American leadership. Certainly with President Trump's public pronouncements about casting doubts on the importance of NATO and the importance of Article 5, which is the U.S. commitment to commit to other NATO countries under attack, and the idea that all NATO members come to the aid of a member state under attack, which was first invoked in 2001 after 9/11 on the behalf of the United States. How do members react to that rhetoric?
Well, I think you have to look at the big picture. I mean, we're in the middle of the biggest reinforcement of NATO's collective defense since the end of the Cold War. So since 2014, NATO has been doing a tremendous amount of work. And, you know, the thing about NATO is that decisions are taken by consensus. It's not just the will of one country. It's the will of 29 of our nations. So, like I say, they've agreed on the biggest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War. That has to do with things like establishing new headquarters in the Eastern countries, in reinforcing the number of troops that are available for rapid reaction or that would be available to respond to a crisis in NATO countries from wherever, whatever direction, right? So you have to look at the progress that we've made and the ability to actually get things done despite differences. I mean, clearly there are differences between NATO allies, and there always have been. Just look at the 70-year history of NATO. But that doesn't impede really quite impressive results and work together.
Now, there's certainly a belief in the United States that the United States has to exert a lot of leadership in NATO. That leadership is not necessarily as apparent in this particular administration. Is that a good thing for NATO, where other members are being forced to step up and take leadership roles, greater leadership roles?
Well, I was talking about the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. I mean, that also goes together with a huge U.S. investment in Europe. You know, I think in the U.S., we often think of Europe as closing down, drawing down the presence after the Cold War, closing bases, et cetera. Actually, the U.S. since 2014 with this European defense initiative, now this is not a NATO initiative, but it complements what NATO is doing, has actually a really increased involvement in Europe in a lot of ways that's very reassuring to European countries. So I think you have to look at it in that light as well. Also, there's the work that we've been doing on burden sharing, of sharing the financial costs. I mean, just to give you a couple of statistics, you know, in 2014, the Allies agreed to, first of all, halt the negative trends in defense spending, so stop the declines. And then by 2024, so over a 10-year period, to devote 2% of GDP toward defense spending. And so we have halted the declines. It's important. And then secondly, since 2016, European countries and Canada have spent an extra $41 billion already on defense, $41 billion. And by next year, they'll have spent $100 billion on defense. So I think if you look at the overall picture of what's going on in NATO and the commitment of states, it's pretty clear that the commitment is there and we're making progress.
What about, though, the U.S. leadership? Because we've really, you know, the U.S. has taken the lead on most initiatives of NATO. And right now you have a president that publicly questions the value of it. He does absolutely talk about the fact that Europeans have not contributed as much in his estimation to collective defense as he thinks they should. And he's openly questioned the Article 5. I think if I was a European country, especially one of the newer members closer to Russia, I'd be very concerned about that Article 5, the reluctance to commit to Article 5. Mm.
Well, I don't want to speak for other allies, but I think if you look at NATO, it's clear that the basis of the alliance is strong. The U.S. leadership is there in so many ways. The U.S. ambassador, former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, is really a leader in the work in the alliance, and the U.S. is very much committed to NATO. Acting Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan was at our meeting of NATO defense ministers recently in Brussels and emphasized the U.S.'s, you know, fundamental commitment to NATO.
Yeah, certainly congressional leaders. I know at that Munich Security Conference, there were congressional leaders saying, we are absolutely committed to NATO. But, you know, I think of how the United States would react if the leader of the country expressed doubt towards their commitment to a relationship with the United States, and then legislative leaders said, oh, no, we're absolutely committed. I don't think we would take that at face value. How do the members of NATO react to that congressional reassurance?
Well, I think it's just a part of a longstanding U.S. support for NATO, and it's a manifestation of that. You know, like I said, the foreign ministers of NATO are going to be hosted by Secretary Pompeo in Washington in exactly a month from now. The NATO heads of state and government, so including President Trump, are going to meet in London in December for a leaders meeting at which they're going to reaffirm NATO. So I think we just have to keep looking at this.
My guest today is Stephen Hill. He is the chief legal advisor to NATO. He's the director of the Office of Legal Affairs, and he is the chief legal advisor to the Secretary General. He's the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking on NATO's 70th anniversary. Well, you mentioned the increase in defense spending by NATO members, and many members are increasing that amount spend on defense, getting to that 2% of GDP figure. Right now, I think, what is it, 5? Nations reach that threshold? Maybe I may be wrong on that. But the one major player that seems to be lagging is Germany, which is the largest European state within NATO. And right now they're about 1.24%, and there's really no plans to get to that 2% figure. Is that something they're continuing to work on, or is it just a matter of their reluctance to spend more on defense?
Well, first of all, I mean, globally speaking about all the allies, you're right that there are a number of countries that are either already at the 2% mark or are very close to hitting it. And remember, the commitment was for 2024. So we're about halfway through that period of our pledge. You know, without talking about the specific numbers about, you know, particular allies, I mean, Germany clearly is committed to increasing its defense spending. If you carefully look at the way the government is approaching the budget process, they have a political will to increase in line with the commitment, and together with the other European allies, we'll just have to see where that comes out. But you know, clearly there are some challenges, but I think we're making progress across the board, and it's something that's supported by all countries. There is not a NATO country that is not committed to getting to that defense pledge.
I want to talk about that Burns-Lute report, because the third part was, I think it's really sort of an existential part of NATO. You know, when NATO was created, the Western democracies to fight communism and totalitarianism in the wake of World War II during the Cold War. And when we think of NATO, we think of them upholding democratic values. Now you have, the report points out that there are three member states in which you're seeing significant repression and suppression of free speech and press, limiting of independence of their court systems. And I'm speaking of Poland, Hungary, and Turkey. And the authors said, NATO has to confront this. Do you sense that is in the minds of the collective membership of the alliance at this point?
Well, NATO is definitely an alliance of values. I appreciate your pointing that out. One thing I actually like to point out about the North Atlantic Treaty, the 70-year-old document, is that in the preamble, it talks about democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law as values that NATO is meant to defend. That's the purpose that we have, this deterrence and defense. That's the reason we're doing all this stuff. I think that, I mean, as a lawyer, it's kind of neat to have a reference to the rule of law in the preamble of our very treaty. NATO is an important way to engage with countries, you know, so whether you're talking about specific countries or whether you're talking more in general, I mean, NATO is a way to bring them on board, to work with them. And, you know, I think that engagement across a wide range of issues is a better way to approach working with other people than another way.
Yeah.
So that's how I look at that question.
Is NATO actually engaging with those countries where we've had reports of press repression and free speech repression?
I mean, NATO is nothing more than the sum of the 29 allies, and it stands for working together every day, you know, to increase our mutual self-defense and to provide for self-help. So we're engaging every single ally every day on a wide range of issues.
Let's talk about some of what you see as some of the challenges facing the alliance down the road. What are the major challenges that you see to the alliance?
Yeah, well, we have a whole division of NATO actually that's devoted towards identifying, you know, future security challenges, emerging security challenges. That includes in the cyber realm. So since 2008, we've really had a huge evolution in taking cyber from being considered a kind of technical issue for the IT guys to, you know, being considered now really a core strategic issue, which I think rightfully so, given what's been happening.
Is it at this point a sort of a core part of the military?
Absolutely. So, for example, in 2014, the heads of state and government of NATO agreed that a cyber attack could, if it rose to the level of it, trigger Article 5. You know, so the most basic thing, provision of our treaty about collective self-defense could actually be triggered by a cyber attack. That's a huge, it sounds very simple and almost self-evident, but it's a huge intellectual evolution. So basically, that was agreed in 2014. And since 2014, we've just been working to shore up the cyber defenses of each of our allies, because in cyber, more than perhaps other things, you know, you're only stronger as strong as your weakest link. So we've been really working to bring up cyber defense. And we're doing things like setting up a cyber operations center within NATO to help our members better coordinate.
Let me ask you, what constitutes a cyber attack today? Because certainly since 2014, we've seen a lot of evidence that Russia meddled in the United States presidential election, quite a bit of evidence that they meddled in Brexit, the Brexit election in the UK. I think there's some evidence that they might have meddled in some of the other European parliamentary and elections as well. Does that constitute a cyber attack? And of course, it wasn't known at the time they were under a cyber attack. It was only in hindsight. Are you talking more like shutting off the power grid or far more serious cyber attacks?
Yeah, well, I think you're pointing at one of the issues, which is that, you know, the number of what we call cyber attacks, just speaking generally, is really on the increase, and is on the rise. So we talk about lots of different kinds of cyber attacks, including the things that you mentioned. I guess from as a lawyer, I always think, you know, what's the threshold of an armed attack? Because that's what the term is used in the North Atlantic Treaty and the Washington Treaty, Article 5. That's what would trigger Article 5. Almost everything in cyber is not going to rise to that level, thankfully, because otherwise we would be pulled into a very serious situation, you know, because we say that we reserve the right to respond to armed attacks using any kind of means. So, you know, we reserve the right to respond to armed attack with conventional forces. So it's very, very serious. But most everything that's occurring on a day-to-day basis is going to be naturally under that threshold. That doesn't mean it's doesn't have serious implications. Financial, safety, also to the convenience of people, of course, but very serious because it involves the infrastructure. So what we've been doing actually in NATO is we're never going to tell people the line at which armed attack would be crossed. That would, you don't want to tell people what's your red line. But we're also working below that line to strengthen cyber defenses. For example, we just came up with a list of kind of a manual of responses that our allies could use to things that are below the armed attack threshold. And we hope that'll be helpful. But, you know, this is an area, once again, where you need international cooperation because the nature of the cyber infrastructure is just so dispersed all over the place that you naturally need a place like NATO to be able to help coordinate that.
Beyond cyber attacks, what would you consider the big challenges confronting NATO in the next couple of years?
Well, the rise of artificial intelligence and what would it be its applications in the military space. You know, if you look at the kind of the way it's discussed in the media, you hear talk about these killer robots and things like that. I don't think that's actually the main issue that we need to be worried about. We need to be worried about things that are much more, much maybe less attention grabbing, but much more important. Like the, you know, we know that artificial intelligence applications run on data. How are we going to, what data do we have amongst NATO countries? How are we going to share it? How are we going to be able to work together to use AI as a force for good and not and combat its use as a force for evil.
Yeah, and of course, with the algorithms that are at the base of AI, it's a matter of how you set up those algorithms in the first place. They oftentimes unconsciously reinforce our own biases. And I assume if you're making AI as a part of decision making, then that becomes very important.
Exactly, because AI, I mean, it can help. I mean, it's not going to substitute for decision makers, but it helps support decision making. And we have to be really careful that we've got a system that helps support our decision making and not lead it down the wrong path.
Let me ask you about a couple other challenges, and that's obviously how does NATO confront? I've heard it put in a number of ways this way: confronting Vladimir Putin, much less than confronting Russia, confronting Russia's leader on Ukraine, on meddling in elections, and protecting Eastern European members. Can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the efforts NATO is doing to either engage Putin or to confront him?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to personalize this because, right. You know, but I mean, and also I think it's important to remember, you know, NATO doesn't want to isolate Russia. We don't want a new arms race or a new Cold War with Russia. We already went through one Cold War. We don't want a new Cold War with Russia. Russia is obviously the neighbor to, I mean, not only NATO generally, but to quite a number of our countries. But obviously, the relationship needs to improve. I think we need to focus on what the problem is. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I focus, as my colleagues do, on the fact that Russia really needs to return to respecting international law. It's nothing more than that. You know, they've used force against their neighbors. They most recently we saw that in the Sea of Azov, a body of water down in the south part of Ukraine. You know, you're talking about interference and cyber attacks. And of course, we have had this issue about the arms control, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So our approach to Russia is basically twofold. So all the things that I was talking about before, a strong defense, a strong deterrence. But, you know, that's just one part of the puzzle. We also try to dialogue. And, you know, we're open to dialogue with Russia. We have a thing that's called the NATO-Russia Council, which is an ambassadorial-level body that meets 3-4 times a year and is a format for Russia. So, you know, that's what we're trying to do. Unfortunately, you know, you wonder if there's a willingness to dialogue from the other side.
Mm. Let's talk about the Afghan war. You're going on 18 years. The United States has sort of declared its intention to leave Afghanistan, if not this year, next year. And we should always remember it's just not the United States in Afghanistan. It's NATO allies, many NATO allies.
Yeah.
What's the position of NATO in how NATO as a group and the United States unilaterally disengage from Afghanistan, since that seems to be, at this point, sort of the end game?
Yeah, I guess from NATO's perspective, we have to remember that the only reason that NATO has ever been in Afghanistan, you know, whether it's when we started after 9/11 with the so-called ISAF mission, or nowadays when we're working, our focus since 2014 has really been focusing on training, advising, and assisting the Afghan military so that they can defend themselves in their own country. The only reason we've ever been there is to create the conditions for a peaceful, negotiated solution to the conflict, and to ensure that Afghanistan never, you know, becomes a safe haven for terrorism again. And I appreciate that you point out, you're right, it's not just even the NATO countries. It's also a lot of partners. So at the height of our ISAF mission that I was mentioning, you know, there were over 50 partners who were there, ranging from Australia to even some countries in Latin America. So we support the efforts that the U.S. is doing right now, Ambassador Khalilzad, to bring the parties into negotiation to get a political settlement. You know, part of the reason that that's possible is because NATO was there and keeping pressure on the Taliban. The U.S. has constantly briefed us about allies, about what's going on, and we're remaining in close contact. So, you know, I think that the message from our side is we are an alliance. We went in together. We'll come out together. And we're ready to provide the security support for Afghanistan to help give these peace negotiations a shot to succeed.
Yeah. It seems like right now the United States is more about acting unilaterally. If they decide to withdraw, I mean, will NATO just follow suit?
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, as I was saying, Ambassador Khalilzad has been to Brussels a number of times. He's actually been briefing us on the negotiations. We're very much in touch. So, yeah, like I said, the approach at NATO is in together, out together. You know, we're willing to do what it takes to help make these efforts a success.
All right. One last issue, the expansion of NATO. There's some that would say the alliance has already grown too large. And, you know, I was seeing a report the other day that Belarus is wanting better relations with NATO. They're not talking about trying to meet the membership requirements, but they're talking about having better relations with NATO. Ukraine sounds like they would very much like to be in. You know, what's the thinking of the NATO membership towards the size of NATO today?
Well, we've been in a period where we have added new countries. So not in addition to North Macedonia, which I hope we'll be able to join fairly soon. We've had Montenegro join NATO recently. You know, every ally brings something to the table. And the thing about NATO is it's not just a kind of a military organization where we look at, you know, literally what asset can you bring to the table. It's about what kind of political support and what kind of solidarity can you bring to the table. And I think that regardless of whether we're talking about a small country like Montenegro or, you know, countries that are now celebrating their 20th anniversary of accession to NATO, like Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary, you know, all these countries bring a huge amount of solidarity to the table. And so I think that NATO is really, I mean, I guess that points to the enduring value of NATO, despite the challenges, you know, over 70 years, is that it's a place that countries are still very much interested in getting into.
Given that it appears that the UK will leave the European Union, does that make, you know, the European Union countries and the UK being together in NATO, that relationship more important?
Well, I think that it really highlights the fact that it's really important to have different fora in which countries are able to talk to each other and to work together. And so, you know, the NATO is not the European Union. We don't have that regulatory kind of authority, and therefore, you know, and we're
Very much about respecting the country's sovereignty.
Exactly. So we don't have the same debates that you have vis-a-vis Brexit, of course. So I think it does point to the value of NATO. I mean, I think that the UK and European Union countries are going to have to continue to work together in a lot of areas, including security, and NATO is a place where they can do that.
All right. Stephen Hill, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stephen Hill is the director of the Office of Legal Affairs at NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and their chief legal advisor. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on the challenges and opportunity confronting NATO as it approaches its 70th anniversary, which takes place next month. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.